Depression was once known as melancholia. Abraham Lincoln suffered from it. Winston Churchill suffered from it and called it black dog. Depression is experienced to some degree by everyone at different times in life. It's been suggested that possibly more suffering has resulted from depression than from any other single impairment affecting mankind. Depression has been called by far the commonest psychiatric problem or symptom. It's found as a temporary condition in almost any normal person who has suffered a great personal disappointment. It's found as the deep suicidal depression of the psychotic. Signs of depression include sadness, apathy, inertia, which makes it difficult to get going or to make decisions, loss of energy and fatigue, often accompanied by insomnia, pessimism, hopelessness, fear, a negative view of self, often accompanied by self-criticism, feelings of guilt, shame, worthlessness, helplessness, a loss of interest in work, loss of interest in usual activities, loss of spontaneity, difficulties in concentration, an inability to enjoy pleasurable activities, and often a loss of appetite. There are some cases called mask depression, where the person denies that he or she is feeling sad, but some of the symptoms indicate that maybe depression is still present behind the smiling face. Sometimes the symptoms of depression hide anger, which has not been expressed, sometimes isn't even recognized, and sometimes is turned inward against oneself. Depressions can occur at any age and are long-lasting in some cases and in other cases short-lived. They come in various types. Reactive depression comes as a reaction to some real or imagined loss or other trauma. There are depressions that seem to arise spontaneously from within. Neurotic depression is often mixed with a high degree of anxiety. Psychotic depression often involves very intense despair and self-destructive attitudes, perhaps accompanied by even a loss of contact with reality. We have chronic, long-lasting depressions that are resistant to treatment. Others are acute, they're intense, but of short duration and often self-correcting. Most people would distinguish all of these from simple discouragement, which is a mild and usually temporary and almost universal mood swing in response to disappointment or failure or loss. The long story short on depression is that it's a very common but very complicated condition that's difficult to define, hard to accurately describe, and not easy to treat. The word depression itself is a clinical term that's not discussed in the Bible per se. However, the psalmist cried out in terms implying depression, and there are several biblical descriptions suggesting depression. Consider the 69th Psalm, for example, and I'm not going to take the time to turn to it and look at portions of it, but there's a lot there that's suggestive of depression. Consider the 88th Psalm, just as an example, from the first verse on. Consider the 102nd Psalm, just as an example. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from me in the day when I am in trouble. Incline thine ear unto me. In the day when I call, answer me speedily. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. My heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. By reason of the voice of my groaning, my bones cleave to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I watch and am as a sparrow alone upon the housetop. Mine enemies reproach me all the day long, and they that are mad against me are sworn against me. For I have eaten ashes like bread, and mingled my drink with weeping, because of thine indignation and thy wrath, for thou hast lifted me up and cast me down. If that's not depression, I don't know what to call it. And yet these songs of despair are set in a context of hope. In the 43rd Psalm, David proclaims both depression and rejoicing. Why are you in despair, O my soul, and why are you disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise Him, the help of my countenance and my God. It seems that Job got depressed, Moses got depressed, Peter got depressed. Jonah got depressed. Jeremiah wrote a whole book of Lamentations. Elijah saw God's mighty power demonstrated on Mount Carmel. But when Jezebel threatened murder, he fled into the wilderness and plunged into despondency. He wanted to die, and he might have, if God hadn't given him some rest and some food and some assurance and a friend. God knew what he needed. Then there was Jesus in Gethsemane, where he was greatly distressed. He began to show grief and distress of mind. He was depressed. And he said unto his disciples, "My soul is very sad and deeply grieved, so that I am almost dying of sorrow." If I may slightly paraphrase Matthew 26, verses 37 and 38. These examples of despair show the realism of the Bible. But this realistic despair is contrasted with a certain hope. Each of the believers who plunged into depression eventually came through to a new and lasting joy. The biblical emphasis is less on the human despair than it is on belief in God and the assurance of abundant life. Paul's confident prayer for the Romans was, "Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Spirit." Romans 15:13. The prevalence of depression in our time is astounding, staggering. It's the common cold of psychopathology, and has in some way, directly or indirectly, touched the lives of us all. And yet, depression may be the most dimly understood, maybe the most inadequately investigated of the major mental distresses. Nevertheless, we do know something about the causes of depression. Depression very often has a physical basis. Lack of sleep, poor diet are among the simplest physical causes. But also there is the effect of drugs and low blood sugar and other chemical issues like brain tumors and glandular disorders that are far more complicated but very, very real. Just to consider the hypothalamus as a minor example here, it's just a little piece of your brain about the size of an almond, but it controls all kind of things. And when it doesn't work right, you can be depressed and not understand why. Severe depression tends to run in families. I'm not saying that depression is inherited like blue eyes, but I am saying that some people are probably more innately prone to depression than others are. It seems that childhood experiences can lead to depression in later life. Depression is more likely when parents blatantly or subtly reject their children, or when they set unrealistically high standards which the children are unable to meet. Failure becomes inevitable and people become depressed. Sometimes depression comes in situations over which we have no control. Loss of job, loss of health, loss of freedom, loss of a game sometimes, loss of possessions, loss of a loved one is one of the biggest depression-producing events in life. When we learn that our actions are futile, no matter how hard we try, depression is commonly a result. We just feel helpless and give up. This can be seen in a grieving person who can do nothing to bring a loved one back. It can be seen in a student who is unable to relate to his peers and is failing academically. It can be seen in an older person who is powerless to turn back the clock and restore their lost physical capacities. When such people are able to control at least a little piece of their environment, often their depression will subside, because control is a major human issue. Some people slip into a pattern of negative thinking in which they see the dark side of life and overlook the positive. Life is seen as just a succession of burdens and obstacles and defeats in a world that itself is going down the drain. They often view themselves as deficient, inadequate, unworthy, incapable, and this can lead to self-blame and self-pity. They view the future negatively, seeing it filled with hardship and frustration and hopelessness. And we have to ask ourselves, is negative thinking a cause of depression or is it a result of depression? And the answer is probably both. It becomes a vicious cycle. Negative thinking can sometimes be used to control the people around us. If I say I'm no good, that's sometimes an unconscious way of getting people around me to say, oh yes, you're a good person. It becomes a way of manipulating others to give compliments. But those kind of compliments really are not very satisfying. Negative thinking can be used as self-protection. If you keep on thinking negatively, you're less likely to be disappointed if some of your negative thinking becomes true. And so then you can say, well, I told you, I knew it. I knew this was going to happen. Anger that Wade was talking about yesterday is an issue that is very closely connected to depression. Many children are raised in homes where the expression of anger is not tolerated in any form. Some people are convinced that they should never feel anger, and so when they do feel it, they deny that they feel it. A widow may feel angry that her husband has died and left her to raise the children alone. But this anger seems rather obviously irrational, and so it arouses guilt feelings in her. The anger is denied and kept within. It festers undercover and eventually can get us down. Most anger begins, and I was thinking about this while Wade was talking yesterday. Most anger begins when we feel hurt, and instead of admitting this hurt, people get angry, and the anger builds and hides the hurt. If the anger is not admitted and dealt with, it leads to revenge, thoughts of hurting the other person. Problem is there that violence is not acceptable either, and so people try to hide their feelings. This takes energy to hide those feelings, and that eventually wears down the body and leads to psychosomatic symptoms. Some people condemn themselves for their attitudes and become depressed, and the result may be an emotional self-punishment where we feel no good and guilty and unhappy. Some people use their depression as a subtle and socially acceptable way to express anger and get revenge. This is probably what's behind so-called passive-aggressive tendencies. Resentment is the accumulation of unexpressed anger. Resentment may be the most destructive emotion in human relationships and in personal well-being. Sometimes people wallow in depression as a means of hurting other people. The depression itself becomes an indirect expression of hostility. Well, I'm depressed, and there's nothing you can do about it, but it's all your fault, and if you don't give me some attention and sympathy, I may get even more depressed and do something desperate. It's a kind of a psychological blackmail. Suicide attempts frequently have this characteristic. Many suicide notes that I have seen have a see what you made me do type of a cast to them, or a now you'll miss me type of a cast to them. And the people blaming others for their bad feelings. Depression often hides underlying hurt, anger, and resentment, which then themselves are forgotten, but the depression remains. This doesn't account for all depression, but undoubtedly explains some of it. Guilt feelings and depression often appear together. In most cases, the guilt comes first. But depression will cause people to feel guilty because they find that they cannot just snap out of it. And so again, we have a vicious cycle. Problems in life can serve a useful purpose. We find this very early in life. We learn it and we use this in different ways. We know, for instance, that if we are physically sick, we are excused from work. People shower us with extra attention and or sympathy. People take over our responsibilities. Sometimes we can enjoy a little R&R if we are physically sick. The same is true when we are emotionally down. We get these same blessings coming our way. Depression does help us to avoid responsibilities and attract attention and have an excuse not to function. Emotionally hurting people realize, however, that the benefits of depression are not really all that satisfying. So they begin to hate what they're doing, and often they end up hating themselves, and this causes more depression. They lack enthusiasm, they're indecisive, they have little energy for even doing simple things like getting out of bed. In some people, depression is hidden even from themselves, so it comes out in other ways, including physical symptoms, aggressive actions, temper outbursts, impulsive behavior, sometimes including gambling, drinking, violence, destructiveness, impulsive sexual activity, accident proneness, compulsive working, and the list goes on. These symptoms of mass depression occur in children and adolescents as well as in adults. Smiling on the outside, but hurting on the inside, and expressing this hurt in ways which hide the real inner despair. There's often a desire of the depressed to get away from other people because social contacts may be too demanding and escape, people want to escape into a world of television or simple novels or alcohol or drug use. Sometimes people dream of running away, and a few people actually do run away from their lives. Suicide and suicide attempts by depressed people are especially prevalent in teenagers and people who live alone and unmarried people, especially the divorced. For some, suicide attempts are an unconscious cry for help, an opportunity for revenge, or a manipulative gesture designed to influence somebody. Some people carefully plan their self-destructive act, while others simply drive recklessly or drink excessively or find other ways to flirt with death. Depressed people are often passive and nonverbal, poorly motivated, pessimistic, and have a what's-the-use attitude. So, how can we help somebody who is depressed? What can we do for each other here? One of the first things we must do with depressed people is to reach out to them verbally, to talk to them, taking a more active role than we might with a different type of a person, because they may not want to talk. But optimistic, reassuring statements, encouraging them to talk, asking questions without probing, giving periodic compliments to them, might help. And we should listen to them when they do talk. Listen to them very, very attentively. Watch for evidences of anger, hurt, negative thinking. Watch for evidences of a poor view of themselves and feelings of guilt. Encourage the person to talk about the situations which are bothersome to them. Try to be understanding. Try to be accepting of the feelings. Watch for talk about losses, failures, and rejections. We each need to ask ourselves this question. When I'm talking with a depressed person, am I impatient about that? Am I willing to let them unreel for a while? Am I inclined to let my mind wander while they're talking? Depressed people provide a test for our Christian love. Be aware of their special need as dependent people. They may be temporarily dependent, but when they're depressed, there is a dependency there. And ask yourself, am I encouraging dependence in an already dependent person? Am I encouraging anger? Am I encouraging negative thinking? It's possible for us to inadvertently increase the depression. So we need to be very careful about the things that we say. There are medical approaches that sometimes must be taken to depression, and especially chronic depression. If you are chronically depressed, I recommend that you get yourself, first of all, a good physical examination by a qualified person. Some of the new generation of antidepressant drugs can be very, very helpful. And there's probably nobody in the room or rooms that is more cynical of the pharmaceutical industry in America than I am at this present time. But still, there is a place for these drugs. And if you need to take a pill, then take a pill. Just be sure that you need it. And it may not have to even be a long-term thing. But there's no shame in taking a pill. They that are sick need a physician, said our master. And sometimes we need the medicines that are provided by the physician. The medical community also continues to experiment with pulsing electricity through the brain, which has helped in some cases of depression. Obviously, it's easier to deal with depression if we can find the physical or psychological or spiritual reasons behind it, which are producing the symptoms. Through questioning and careful listening, we might be able to gain clues. Is there a learned helplessness in this person? Help the person learn how to accomplish certain things. Discuss the inevitability of uncontrollable events and stress that in a large sense, God is always in control. Is there negative thinking in the person that you're talking with? Ask the person to state some of their negative thoughts, and ask them then if a particular conclusion is really valid. Could there be another way of viewing the situation? If somebody says to you, well, my dad just likes to see me miserable, so he's making me finish high school. What can you say? Well, you could ask that person, can you think of any other possible reason why a father might want his teenage son to finish school? Besides the fact that he wants to see you miserable, is there any other possible conclusion that you could come to about that father? In other words, are you telling yourself things about the world and about yourself and about the people around you and about the future which really are not so? Gently challenge the person's thinking and teach him or her a habit of evaluating negative ideas and learning to think more positive. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 needs to be our theme. Whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report. You know the list as well as I do. If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Think on these things. You think that can't make a difference? I know it can. I know it can. Is there stress concerning a loss? Discuss the practical ways that life can go on. Is there revenge covering anger and anger covering hurt? These emotions must be discussed. They must be expressed, even if they seem irrational. Hurt can be deeply embedded and sometimes is uncovered only after considerable probing and lots of careful listening. And hurt can so easily lead to depression. Are there feelings of guilt? Are they legitimate or illegitimate? What is the cause of these feelings of guilt? Has the person confessed the problem to God? Have they confessed to other people if appropriate? Does this person know about divine forgiveness? And what about forgiving oneself? We might want, in a tentative way, to give some of our insights and observations to the person when we've considered their case and get their reactions to that. But whatever we do, we find that most people do not just snap out of depression. The road to recovery is generally long and hard and marked by mood fluctuations. Encourage people to ponder their automatic thoughts. By automatic thoughts, I mean what you just automatically think in certain situations in life. What are your automatic thoughts? When a problem or a disappointment arises, what do you think? You know, a lot of people think, well, this proves that I'm no good. This proves that I never do anything right. These self-criticisms usually are not based on solid fact. Re-evaluate depression-producing thoughts and attitudes. Challenge them and see if they make sense. I knew a woman. She learned that her depression came from an attitude which said, I should be the perfect hostess, the perfect mother, the perfect wife, the perfect friend. I should never fail. I should contribute to the community by serving on committees. I should make contributions to everybody who asks. She set such high expectations for herself that it was impossible to reach them, and when she failed, she became depressed. Yes, we need to hold ourselves to standards, but we need to make sure they're God's standards. Hold ourselves to God's standards with a balance that acknowledges human frailty. We need to make out a list of our own personal priorities and then figure out how much we can do without becoming angry, frustrated, exhausted, and sorry for ourselves when we fail. We can help each other. We can help each other evaluate attitudes and expectations and values and assumptions. We can help ourselves see which ideas are unrealistic, which ideas are non-biblical, which ideas are harmful. We're talking, though, about thoughts that have become well entrenched, resulting usually from a lifetime of thinking. So it may take repeated efforts to help people reevaluate and change their attitudes. When people are depressed, they want to feel better. But feelings by themselves are hard, if not impossible, to change. Telling a person, you shouldn't feel depressed, only adds to the depression by adding extra guilt feelings to what they had before. And most of us cannot change our feelings at will. To change feelings, we must change thinking and or actions. But inaction is common in depressed people. So how are we going to help them? It's much easier to just stay in bed or sit alone brooding about the misery. That does not help the depression. So how can we help them? Depressed people need to be gently encouraged to act. Encourage them to do things which they are likely to succeed in. That increases optimism as they do something successfully. And it interrupts the tendency to just ruminate on negativity. When the person does take action, encourage them and compliment them in this. Try to protect depressed people from harming themselves. Sometimes depressed people will want to change jobs when they really shouldn't. Sometimes depressed people want to quit school when they'd really be much better off to continue. Sometimes depressed people will tend to make unwise marriage decisions. Help people see that two miserable people do not make a happy couple. A lot of times there is a misconception about this. Two unhappy people will find each other and they'll want to get married so they'll be happy, but it doesn't work out that way. Try to help people see this. Help people see the possible consequences of whatever decision you're discussing. And If all you can do is urge them to wait a while, that may be enough. You don't have to say, just don't do that, but just the idea of wait a while. Could you wait a while on that? Wait a while and give it some time. That can be a very meaningful thing. A lot of times depressed people contemplate suicide. Most of them give prior clues about their intentions. I don't think that you and I should hesitate to ask a person if they have been thinking of suicide. I think that's a perfectly legitimate question. It's a realistic question, and it gets the question of suicide out in the open and lets the person consider it rationally in the context of a discussion with a fellow Christian who hopefully is not depressed. Rather than encouraging suicide, as is often assumed, open discussion of it tends to reduce its likelihood. If somebody does threaten suicide, take that threat seriously. Try to be available, at least by phone. Take the person to the hospital, contact their doctor, contact their relatives, whatever needs to be done. But we can also have rational discussions with people, especially if they have repeatedly threatened suicide. One time, a number of years ago, early on a Sunday morning, a man called me and he was at the end of his rope. He said, I'm going to kill myself. There's no reason for me to continue on. I've had enough of this and she'll be better off without me. So I'm just going to do away with myself now. I said, well, maybe she will be better off without you, but as soon as you're dead, she's going to call me and want me to do a funeral for you. And I don't have time for a funeral this week. Could you wait until Thursday to kill yourself? Now, I knew this man very well. I knew his patterns. I knew his thinking. Could you wait until Thursday, and that should throw your funeral into next week when I'll have a better opportunity to do it? He said, yes, I can wait until Thursday. We continued to talk for quite some time, and I finally said to him, will you promise me one thing, that you will not kill yourself until you've talked with me again? He said, yes, I make that promise to you. And I knew that I could trust his word. That man never did kill himself. He was encouraged to wait a while, and things looked different on Thursday than they had on Sunday morning. I think this is a legitimate type of a conversation to have. That man is dead now of natural causes, and I probably wouldn't have used his example if he was still with us. By the way, if a person is truly determined to kill themselves, there is little that anybody can do to prevent it. We all need to remember this when somebody does commit suicide. Otherwise, you and I may wallow in feelings of unrealistic guilt. It may not be possible or even desirable to prevent all discouragement, but I do believe that long-lasting depressions are preventable if we use all the means that we have at our disposal. We need to learn to trust in God. Paul learned to be content, whatever his circumstances were. He learned to live joyfully, both in poverty and in prosperity. A conviction that God is alive and in control can give tremendous help. If we cultivate that conviction, discouragements need not hit us as hard as they otherwise might. The second verse of What a Friend We Have in Jesus in our Red Songbooks, and I'm not suggesting that you turn there because I think you're all familiar with the song. The second verse of What a Friend We Have in Jesus says, we should never be discouraged. I do not agree with that. I don't think there's any scriptural support for it, that we should never be discouraged. There is nothing spiritually, ethically, or morally wrong with cloudy days and dark nights. Jesus warned that we would have problems. James said that trials will come to test our faith and to teach us patience. And when he said count it all joy, he didn't mean to pretend that we never get discouraged. Our Lord, as we've seen just before his crucifixion, was deeply distressed and openly acknowledged it. One can hardly think of the Lord smiling in Gethsemane or on the cross, trying to convince everybody that he was just bubbling over with happiness. He trusted his Father, but he expected pain, and he was not surprised when it came. When we're realistic enough about life to expect pain, and we're informed enough about life to know that God is always in ultimate control, we can handle discouragement and often keep from slipping into a deep depression. Some people slide into depression because they dwell on past injustices or past failures. We must ask God to help us forget the past. We must forgive those who have sinned against us, and we must forgive ourselves. All of these are very important. The church needs to continue to teach people to admit their anger and their guilt and to show how these can be overcome. If people learn to handle anger and guilt, much depression can be prevented. It seems, to me at least, that all of us silently talk to ourselves all day long. We may not even be aware of that interior conversation because it's just so natural to us. From the time we awaken till the time we go to sleep, and perhaps through the night, we're still talking to ourselves. We need to be very, very careful in paying attention to the things that we say to ourselves. In 1 Samuel chapter 27, verse 1, David says to himself, and this is in the context of the time when he's running from Saul, and every time he falls, it seems like Saul is a step closer to him, and it seems like Saul's going to get him. David says to himself, 1 Samuel 27, 1, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. Was that true? That wasn't true. Not only was that not true, that David was not going to perish by the hand of Saul, but David knew that was not true. He knew what the predictions had been. He knew what Samuel had told him, what Jonathan had told him. David knew the truth, but he told himself a lie and managed to believe it and feel sorry for himself about it. And the result was predictable. 16 long months of compromise. We don't have time to go through that story. But there's a lot to that story, beginning in 1 Samuel 27 and on through for several chapters there, until finally, when his own men have turned against him and are talking about stoning him, alone in the smoldering ruins of Ziklag, David finally looks up for the first time in 16 months. And he learns, long story short, that the purpose of depression was not to throw him on his back, but to drive him to his knees. If I tell myself that I am incompetent, I need to ask, what is the evidence for this? In what areas am I incompetent? Is it bad to be incompetent in some things? How can I become more competent? When we challenge our own thinking and the thinking of others, this can prevent or reduce the severity of depression. The Bible talks about meditation on the Word of God. This directs the mind away from the negative. People can be overprotected. We do need to protect each other when that's legitimate, but we can overprotect people. This interferes with their ability to learn how to cope or to master the stresses of life. If people can see how others cope and learn from that how to cope themselves, then circumstances will seem less overwhelming and depression becomes less likely. Religious people are less suicide prone than non-religious people, because religion integrates people into groups where they are less lonely and less isolated. The church is a therapeutic community given to us by God. Here we have, as was said this morning, the finest people that the world has to offer, such as we are. That doesn't mean we're perfect, doesn't mean we don't have a lot of flaws, but here we have the finest people that the world has to offer. A concerned group of people who have learned to be caring can do so much to soften the trauma of crisis and provide strength and help. When our son was killed 3 years ago, the church was just absolutely wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. And we thank you for that. Depressed people help themselves when they reach out to help others. Those who help are the ones who benefit and are helped the most. When we help people, including depressed people, it does wonders to keep ourselves from being depressed. Of course, the motive here is very important. It won't help me much if I don't really care about other people, but I help them as a way to help me feel better. But when there is a true caring reaching out, everybody is helped and depression is reduced. There's nothing in the world like the stimulation of the helping community that the Lord calls the church. God delivered Peter from prison, but left John the Baptist in prison to be murdered. But they both ultimately were okay. No two of us have the same circumstances in life, but we can all ultimately be okay. So let's have a realistic perspective on life and death.